Funding for Think is made possible by SMU's informal courses for adults.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. Who profits from sex slavery, and why is the victim count on the rise? My guest today, whose first career was in investment banking, changed focus to put his financial analysis skills to work as a member of the board of directors for the human rights organization Free the Slaves. In hopes of taking a pragmatic approach to ending a shameful crime, he has just published a book explaining the economic realities of what has become a global industry, the sexual enslavement of an estimated 1.2 million people. Siddharth Kara's new book is called Sex Trafficking, Inside the Business of Modern Slavery, and he joins us now to talk about it. Siddharth, welcome to Think.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
So your first experience with this problem, interestingly enough, came when you were an undergrad and you went to work at a refugee camp in Slovenia. What did you observe there?
That's right. This was the mid-1990s, and I put together a project to volunteer in refugee camps in Bosnia. I heard a lot of terrible stories that summer, as you can imagine, one of which had to do with Serbian soldiers who would go into Bosnian villages, execute the men, and round up the women and children to traffic them across Central Europe to brothels. This was the first time I came across the practice of sex trafficking.
And it was something that you sort of kept, you had a hard time forgetting about it, even as you started work in commercial banking.
That's right. I came back to the States. I got my degrees, went on and got an MBA, was working in the corporate sector, and these stories still haunted me, and I realized that not nearly enough research was being done, and there was not nearly enough awareness of these crimes.
What makes sex slavery in particular so profitable?
Well, if you take a step back and look at the business model of sex slavery, it is a high-profit, low-cost business to be involved in. Each and every day, these sex slaves are forced to perform 15, 20, 25 or more sex acts, and every one of these sex acts generates profit for the exploiter.
And these mostly they're women, are purchased in some places for as little as $200.
Or even less, yes. I've actually calculated the average cost of a sex slave around the world to be just under $2,000. You've got highs of maybe $7,500 to $10,000 in parts of Europe and even North America. But then throughout Asia, Southeast Asia and South Asia, you can buy slaves for as little as $200, sometimes even less.
So you traveled all over the world for this project to interview sex slaves sort of in the field. You went to brothels in different places. How and where were you able to find them?
Well, I realized early on that to really understand what was happening, I needed to go out into the field and see for myself. So I really just jumped into it, and I tried to track down slaves the best way I knew how, which was going into red light areas, tracking down brothels, clubs, massage parlors, other places where there was a suspicion of this type of exploitation. I also liaised with local experts, people who were running shelters for victims who had lots of information on where and how to track down slaves.
You did set some ground rules for yourself, starting with the idea that whatever happened, you didn't want your presence in any particular person's life to make things any worse for these slaves.
That's right. Rule number one was do no harm. So when I went into a sex establishment, I tried to use my best judgment in attempting to solicit any sort of conversation. If I felt any risk would result to the slave, I just didn't try. And I never returned to an establishment more than once. The reason for this is that slave owners know that they're committing crimes, and the loyalty of slaves is of paramount importance to them. So they'll plant a fake human rights worker sometimes, promising freedom for information, and if the slave opens their mouth, they will be severely punished.
So you definitely had the sense, in many cases, that these women didn't trust you when you told them. You didn't lie about who you were once you got inside.
No. Once I got inside, I, of course, pretended to be a consumer, and if I had the opportunity to sit down with an individual in a private area, a room, or a back area, I presented who I was. I was a researcher from the United States trying to understand the nature of this exploitation. More often than not, the person was just too nervous to talk. I never pushed it. I left some money, and if they were willing to accept it, some information on local shelters and police, and I left.
Was there ever a time when someone said, "Help me"?
You know, not really. And the reason is there's so much fear about the consequences of trying to escape or trying to accept any sort of help. Slave owners not only threaten the slaves, but they threaten their family members. So there is an extreme amount of fear to do anything that would upset them. Now, when I had a sense that a person maybe at some later point might contemplate attempting to escape or attempting to help themselves, I would try to leave information on local resources they could reach out to. But at no time was I able to take the hand of an individual and walk them out of that condition of slavery and straight over to a shelter.
So, Siddharth, how did you get them to tell you about their lives?
Well, I never approached them with a list of questions. Mm-hmm. I just had a casual conversation. And if they wanted to talk about me, we talked about me. If they wanted to talk about their daily lives, we talked about that. And if they wanted to talk about their ordeals, we talked about that too. And the interesting thing is that under the conditions of just a casual conversation, a lot of people really poured their hearts out. And they did so understanding that I was a researcher and that if they spoke, their voices just might be heard.
You also find a lot of people seem to be in denial about the state of their lives.
Well, as you can imagine, slaves undertake a wide range of adaptive mechanisms to survive their ordeals. That includes alcohol and drug abuse. It also includes accepting their fates. And this is a very morose acceptance, but they come to accept that the life of a slave may be the best life for them, and that's the best way for them to survive these daily doses of abuse, torture, and rape.
What kinds of conditions are they typically living in? Is it possible to make a blanket statement about that?
Well, the conditions are wretched. There's really no other word for it. They are subjected to savage abuse. They are utterly exploited. They're kept in a condition of complete physical, psychological, and emotional wreckage. And this is to the advantage of the slave owner because they are then broken down into submitting to this terrible, terrible fate.
And what are the prospects for someone who's able to actually break free?
They're relatively grim. There are people who break free, and I've interviewed several scores of slaves in shelters around the world. Very often, they are addicted to drugs and alcohol. They are infected with STDs, especially HIV/AIDS. They may be shunned by their families. They may not have any sort of educational or employment opportunities. They may not be able to get back home. They may not have a home to get back to, and they can only stay in the shelter so long. So the fates of these individuals are relatively grim.
Yeah, you met one young woman whose family sold her under false pretenses. They didn't understand that she was going to become a sex slave, but once she got away and they found out she had HIV, wouldn't take her back in.
Yes. Deceit and trickery is one of the chief tools that slave traders use to recruit new victims. But they often recruit in rural communities that can be very conservative. And whether it's Central Europe or Asia, when a family finds out that an individual has been involved in sex work, whether by choice or not, that can bring a lot of shame to the family, believe it or not, and they may shun these individuals and not want them to return.
As we stated at the top, this is illegal everywhere. Was it your experience that in a lot of places, the police, even if they knew what was going on, would just ignore the problem?
Police were often a part of the problem. They accepted bribes to allow these illegal operations to operate. They were often consumers of sex slaves. So police and law enforcement in general were often complicit in these crimes, allowing the slave owners to profit with impunity.
How often are Johns aware that they are sleeping with someone who is a slave as opposed to just a prostitute?
I've had a limited number of conversations with the customers, and one thing I found is that awareness of the status of the individual, i.e. either a quote-unquote willing prostitute or a coerced slave, didn't really factor into their logic. What factored into their decision to purchase a particular individual for commercial sex was the price, and slaves, by their inherent nature, are not paid. They're slaves. So the slave owner can charge a much lower price as a result, and that draws in a wider number of consumers, and it draws consumers to return more often.
Well, it's really interesting because that also obviously points to a solution. If you're able to somehow reduce the profitability of this, then the prices go up, and then there are fewer people victimized.
That's exactly right. A key thesis of my book is that the enormity and pervasiveness of the global sex trafficking industry is driven by its ability to generate immense profits at almost no real risk. And the solutions I describe in my book and the tactics I propose are designed to invert that risk-reward profile, to make the commission of these crimes much more risky and much less rewarding.
Let's talk about why the problem has grown so much worse since the fall of the Berlin Wall. Can you give us a little background on that?
That's right. Berlin Wall came tumbling down in 1989, and shortly thereafter, the U.S. Treasury, the IMF, imposed a set of fiscal and monetary policies on transition countries in the former Soviet bloc, meant to assist their transition to a market economy. Now, these were aggressive market economy principles that led to extreme economic collapse, deepening rural poverty, disenfranchisement of the poor, and the net extraction of wealth and resources from poor countries to richer countries. The result was social breakdown that unleashed a massive migration trend of people trying to escape these conditions, escape the instability and the poverty. And, of course, slave traders were able to exploit these trends with shrewd brutality.
So it sort of started the business then. At this point, it is global. And we should make a point here of letting people know this is not just a problem in faraway places. There are sex slaves in Europe and there are sex slaves in North America.
That's right. I spend one chapter in my book on the United States. By my calculation, there are 10,000 sex slaves here in the United States trafficked from dozens of countries around the world. Now, that may be a smaller number, 10,000 slaves, than many other countries, but it's a number we should not tolerate.
Mm-hmm. And talk for a minute about where these slave holders are operating, apartments in some cases and massage parlors.
Yeah, there are a handful of venues in which sex slaves are exploited, and I track down each one in almost every country I visited. And that includes traditional brothels, smaller apartment brothels, clubs, sex clubs, or bar clubs that also have sex slaves in them, massage parlors, street corners, hotels, you name it. Any venue in which consumers can find commercial sex, these exploiters have slaves available.
What puts people at risk for becoming a slave?
Well, poverty is obviously a primary supply-side driver. In fact, the supply of slaves, sex slaves or otherwise, has been promoted for centuries by broad factors relating to poverty, military conflict, social instability, and lawlessness, as well as bias against ethnicity and gender.
Yeah, it becomes very clear in this book that in most parts of the world, women are nowhere equal to men in terms of the rights that they have.
No, it's well documented that around the world, particularly in developing countries, there is a severe asymmetry in female access to education and employment opportunities and justice. And that asymmetry is a prime driver of the vulnerability to slavery.
Are there male sex slaves?
By my calculation, the sex slave industry is less than 5% male. There are boys, young boys, who are trafficked into sexual servitude, but the preponderance of the slaves are women and young female children.
Siddharth Kara is my guest. He's on the board of directors of Free the Slaves. His new book is called Sex Trafficking, Inside the Business of Modern Slavery. We'll return to our conversation after the break, and we will talk about seven ways that Siddharth says we may be able to stop this problem once and for all. You can join our conversation by calling 1-800-933-5372 or send an email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think is made possible by SMU's continuing and professional education. Hundreds of non-credit personal enrichment and professional development courses beginning in January. Details online at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is a member of the board of directors of Free the Slaves, Siddharth Kara. His new book is called Sex Trafficking, Inside the Business of Modern Slavery. If you'd like to join us, you can call 1-800-933-5372 or send an email to think@kera.org. You do have some concrete ideas for starting to chip away at this problem, and it begins with international cooperation. Can you talk about the form that ought to take?
Yeah, let me preface the tactics I propose by saying that these tactics are the result of a very specific business analysis of the sex trafficking industry. And that business analysis reveals what I believe are the optimal tactics to eradicate the crimes. The first tactic is the one you mentioned, the creation of an international slavery and trafficking inspection force that would be operationally similar to the weapons inspectors utilized by the United Nations. If someone like me can go out into the world and track down slaves, an elite trafficking force can certainly track them down, free the victims, and bring the slave owners to justice.
Is there an appetite for that, given a global climate where people fear violence on a broad scale, as opposed to individual victimization?
I think there has to be. Slavery is a moral stain on humankind, and it's illegal in every country in the world, but we don't follow through. We don't deploy the resources required to eradicate this crime once and for all. And the moral outrage of these crimes should be sufficient for us.
And second, you have this idea of vigilance within the community, which starts with reaching out to people who might actually have contact with these individuals who are being trafficked and forced into sex work.
That's right. Police and law enforcement can't be everywhere at once. And what I'd like to establish is something I describe in the book, a system of paid community vigilance committees, which consists of members of the community who are the front lines, eyes and ears of a sort of new brand of global abolitionist movement. They will go out into the community, just as I did in my research, and look for signs of slaves, then report back to the police force, which can then conduct investigations, gather evidence for prosecutions, and free the victims.
It's interesting that you say paid, because a lot of people might think that this is the sort of work that doesn't necessarily require compensation, but I suppose that holds people accountable to the task.
Well, A, there's accountability, and of course, if people want to volunteer, come and accept training, that's great. But in many parts of the world where you find slaves, people are poor and don't have a job. And this is a way to motivate and compensate people for being involved in their community and tracking down these slaves. Economics is at the basis of so many crimes, and economics is at the basis of the solution to so many crimes. We have to be realistic. We need resources to make sure we make it worthwhile for people to go out and track down slaves.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's speak to Ken in Wise County. Hi, Ken.
Hello. I salute and applaud your efforts to help these mostly kids, I'm sure. But one would think that the multi-tens of millions of dollars that televangelical organizations like Widemouth Frog Copeland, do you see these people out there on the trail anywhere? Thank you very much.
Thanks for your call. A lot of involvement from the religious community?
You know, the faith-based communities have been involved in the anti-slavery movement, and it's a logical thing for them to be involved in. This is slavery is a moral stain. It is not in keeping with almost any religious tradition, and faith-based communities and organizations have certainly been involved in raising awareness and in donating funds and in setting up NGOs that deal with this issue.
Are there particular success stories of NGOs that are working in certain places in the world?
Yes. Well, I serve on the board of Free the Slaves, as you mentioned, so I certainly feel that's a successful organization. But in my book, I do identify several small and nonprofits that are dealing with slavery, that are resource-constrained, but are filled with dedicated people who are out there attempting to free these slaves and attempting to help them get their lives back on track.
An email from Emily asks, what happens to sex slaves as they get older?
Well, very often they don't get older. Very few studies have been done on the life expectancy of sex slaves, this being a relatively newer phenomenon in the last 18 to 20 years. But I did speak to an expert in Bombay who's been working with sex slaves there for more than a decade, and she said in her studies, most don't survive past their mid-30s. Hmm. So if you make it free, and that's a big if, again, you will have infection with STDs, you will be addicted to drugs and alcohol, you may be shunned from your home, you probably cannot find a job or an educational opportunity. Life is a bleak sentence.
What happens when they get pregnant?
Well, when they get pregnant while being enslaved, you have a series of painful forced abortions. And that is something that several slaves in shelters told me they had to go through time and again.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. My guest is Siddharth Kara. His new book is called Sex Trafficking, Inside the Business of Modern Slavery. Let's go next to Bill in Dallas. Hello, Bill.
Hi. Excellent show. Thank you for running it, and thank you for your work. I have a quick question about, and it's related to a previous question, about the International Justice Mission and Gary Hogan, if you're familiar with the organization and their effectiveness, and I'll take my answer off the air. Thank you.
Thanks for your call.
Yeah, I'm very familiar with IJM, the International Justice Mission, and they do fantastic work. They are a faith-based organization, but they've got a group of attorneys and field workers around the world in Asia, centered in D.C., and they do fantastic work dealing with exploited women and children, slaves, and trafficking victims.
So let's move down your list of ideas for making sure that this is not a profitable business anymore. One of the things that you think has to happen is that there are raids against establishments where slaves are used, and they have to be targeted raids. This is something that you want specifically to go toward places first where slaves are being forced to work.
Yeah, this is a sensitive one because one of the dangers in police conducting raids is to run in with a blaze of guns and shouting and cause further trauma to victims or to terrorize the victims, cause them fear, or to make them feel so frightened that they don't want to be involved in the jurisprudence process afterwards. So raids are necessary. We have to free the slaves. As long as they're enslaved, they're generating profits for their slave owners. So we have to go in there in a targeted and intelligent fashion, and this police force I described would liaise with local NGOs who subscribe to a set of conditions and victim treatment. They go in there intelligently after conducting surveillance to cause a minimal amount of chaos, let's say, and there must be protections in place to minimize the adverse effects against the individuals, whether they're slaves or otherwise, inside these establishments. But we can't sit back and be reactive. We'll never rid the world of slavery if we are reactive. We have to be proactive.
There are some parts of the world where buying sex has become criminalized to a greater extent than selling sex. Would that help in this case?
This is another really sort of hot button issue. Should the solicitation of commercial sex be criminalized? Europe provides a good sort of case study of this. In Sweden, the solicitation of sex was criminalized in 1999, I think. And in Amsterdam, a year later in 2000, brothels were made legal. And what's been interesting is there's sort of preliminary data back that the criminalization of solicitation in Sweden has had some positive effect on slowing the level of trafficking and slowing the level of consumer demand for commercial sex. That speaks to the risk we need to elevate in the system. Conversely, in Amsterdam, there's been preliminary evidence that the legalization has led to creating a legal veneer behind which slaves can be exploited, so increased trafficking levels and increased exploitation, such that recently I think the mayor of Amsterdam has discussed shutting down or considering shutting down some of these brothels and considering recriminalizing.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. We're talking with Siddharth Kara, author of the book Sex Trafficking, Inside the Business of Modern Slavery. Let's go next to Denton and speak to John. Hi, John.
Hi. I had a question for your guest about Internet sex sites like camera sites and that kind of stuff. How many sex slaves did you find using or being solicited for on the Internet itself?
Yeah, this is something that we're just starting to get some research into this. The Internet is certainly used to buy and sell slaves, and it is also used to solicit consumers to purchase commercial sex. And I know, for example, recently on Craigslist, there was a lot of talk about the sale of sex from prostitutes or slaves. and to the point that Craigslist has eliminated that type of listing from their website. Organized crime groups are very active in using the Internet for all facets of their business, trading in human beings as well as selling commercial sex, and a lot more needs to be done to understand the use of the net and how to thwart these people.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. The email address is think@kera.org. Sort of related email here from Chris, who asks, do you have any statistics on how much the pornography industry is involved in either trafficking or using slaves?
That I don't have. I don't have statistics on the involvement in the pornography industry in trafficking slaves. I can, however, say that there are several documented cases here in the United States, as well as abroad, of trafficking in women and children for exploitation in the pornography industry. In fact, there have been some legal cases here in the United States involving individuals who trafficked women into the country and then forced them to submit to pornographic exploitation.
One of the other things that you want to see put in place in order to make a difference here is more additional money for police officers and for prosecutors working specifically to find sex slaves. Can you talk about how that money would best be spent?
Yeah, this gets back to minimal risk. Around the world, particularly in poor countries, prosecutors and judges are paid very low salaries. For example, in Moldova, a senior prosecutor is paid $150 a month and a judge $200 a month. Well, when a slave trader ends up in their courtroom who can make tens of thousands of dollars per year per slave, he can offer a bribe of 1 year's income for these people to requalify the charges, reduce the charges, or eliminate them altogether. So bribes, because of these low salaries, thwart the justice process, which is why I've said we need to, A, create sort of specialized fast-track courts that have international observers and judicial review, as well as elevated funding for these prosecutors and for these judges to circumvent or prevent the effect of bribery on thwarting justice.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go next to Scott in Fort Worth. Hi, Scott.
Hi, yes. The question I have is, at what point in your analysis do you make the distinction between a prostitute and a sex slave? In other words, someone who is, say, constrained by their economic circumstances such that they feel forced into prostitution as opposed to a sex slave per se, where do you draw that line? And I'll take my answer off the air.
Thanks.
There are very intelligent arguments that any form of prostitution is slavery because coercion can take many forms. It can take the form of economic coercion, familial coercion. So the important thing is, in my analysis, I adhere to a very strict definition of slavery, which is an individual who is held captive and coerced to work against their will through violence or the threat of violence without compensation. Using that strict definition, I'm able to identify that there are 1.2 million sex slaves in the world. But there are cogent arguments that a broader definition of coercion or enslavement would include a broader category of people in the prostitution industry.
Yeah, and it's not necessarily that the lives of people who maybe choose is the wrong word, but who are prostitutes starting of their own will. In other words, you're starting with slaves because that's a good place to start, but it's not a matter of saying that prostitutes' lives are much better, is it, than these slaves?
No, they may suffer many of the same abuses and tortures, absolutely. But yes, we are starting right here with something that we can all agree is morally unacceptable. That is an ugliness that we should not tolerate, and that is out-and-out slavery.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Let's speak next to Charles in Dallas. Hi, Charles.
Hey, how's it going?
Great, thanks.
Great. This is a great topic, and I'm glad to know that there are people out there that are working to stop the tide of human trafficking. My question is, what cities act as the major clearinghouses for human trafficking? And I'll take my answer off here.
Thanks for your call.
Mm-hmm. Well, if we're talking about the United States, I assume, trafficking to the United States is actually a much more difficult and expensive exercise than throughout Europe and Asia, where countries are much smaller and all crammed next to each other. You either have to take a transoceanic flight, in which case your major ports of entry are cities like New York, Los Angeles, San Francisco, Or you make a land crossing through Texas, Arizona, California, into Texas, Arizona, California, from Mexico. So you do have Latin American slaves who are herded up into the border regions and who cross the border through these into these states. Now, the interesting thing is, because there's already such a high level of migration across those the Mexican border, a lot of slave traders just wait on the other side. They don't even take the risk of trying to transport people, understanding that a lot of people are desperate and transport themselves. And they wait on the other side and say, hi, I've got a great job offer for you, and then they've got a slave.
This is sort of a related issue. Can you talk for a minute about why our very globalized economy makes it easier to traffic in slaves?
Well, yeah. The globalized economy has done a few things. It's brought down borders, which makes it easier to pass from one country to another. It has allowed for the easier or less expensive transportation. You know, for example, the cost of an air ticket has dropped by 90% from 1920 to today. So it is much, much less expensive to transport people around the world than it was during, let's say, the North Atlantic slave trade days, where it was you had to take a ship that took a few weeks to cross the Atlantic. So borders have come down. Passports, visas, and documents are relatively easy to forge, and the expense in transportation, whether it's train, truck, by foot or by plane, is relatively inexpensive compared to the profits that can be enjoyed, tens of thousands of dollars a year, by the exploitation of sex slaves.
Siddharth Kara is my guest. He's a member of the board of directors of Free the Slaves. His new book is called Sex Trafficking, Inside the Business of Modern Slavery. We'll take more of your calls right after the break. The telephone number is 1-800-933-5372. And you can also send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think is made possible by SMU's continuing and professional education. Hundreds of non-credit personal enrichment and professional development courses beginning in January. Details online at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is a member of the board of directors for the organization Free the Slaves. His name is Siddharth Kara. His new book is called Sex Trafficking, Inside the Business of Modern Slavery. If you want to join us, you can call 1-800-933-5372. That is where we find Vanita in Dallas. Hello, Vanita.
Hi.
Hi. Go ahead, please.
Hi, this is Anita Benitez, and I'm the founder of Global Slavery Remembrance Day. I'm in Dallas, Texas, and I have a question. The United Nations indicates in a book that was given to me called The Slave Trade that there are 300 million slaves in our world today and that there are 249 million between the ages of 5 and 18 years old. I just have a question when... is it Mr. Carr? Says
Carr.
28 million. Is he referring to, in a global way, is he referring to the 28 million just, you know, in the United States or, you know, really literally 28? Because it's such a difference from 28 million versus the United Nations in 2006. And I have the book, and it's published, Slave Trade. It says 249 million. Of them range between 5 and 18, and I would imagine a percentage of it would be other types of modern-day slavery as well.
Thanks for your call. And Siddharth, maybe you can talk about that, because it is a figure that is, the figures for the number of slaves globally are often very different.
Yeah, the figures are very much predicated on the definition used, and the wider a definition you use, obviously the more number of, greater number of people who get included. I think the International Labor Organization came out with a number of 12.3 forced laborers in 2005. My number is 28.4 million slaves around the world, and there are other estimates of around 27 million, and obviously the UN's got a higher number. I think we have to think about the definition that's being used, and I use a very strict definition, which is individuals who are held captive and coerced to work against their will through violence or the threat of violence without compensation. Now, if you start including people who are paid very low wages, maybe a dollar a day, $2 a day, something that is obviously incommensurate with the work they're doing, you then get it into the 200 or 300 million people range.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's speak next to Ed in Arlington. Hi, Ed.
Hi. I wonder if your guest, if the upshot of what he's saying is, given his bleak assessment or the prospects of women currently enmeshed in this trafficking scheme, if the upshot is that it's really there isn't anything you can do for the women who are currently caught up in it, and that what his efforts are really aimed at is preventing the next wave of girls, women, getting caught up. And with that being said, I wonder if the assessment really needs to be that bleak, if rather than wishing that the economic demand for sex slaves or sexual services would go away, which I don't think is going to happen anytime soon, maybe more effort needs to be put into rehabilitating the women enmeshed in it and taking a more active role in showing them alternative ways of making a living, or at least them providing their services in a way in which they're not slaves, which they are the masters of their income.
Thanks for your call.
Yeah, great question. Part of the bleakness with today's sex slaves has to do with the deep paucity of resources and effort being deployed to assist those individuals who have managed to break free. As you can imagine, they need a high level of psychological care, medical care, employment and educational opportunities, or the ability to learn a trade. And they need to be able to be in a shelter where they can be safe for however long it takes. Almost in all countries I visited, none of those conditions are true. There's not enough resources, not enough teaching of a vocation or a trade, not enough psychological and medical health care, and shelters have limits. So the sentence would not be nearly as bleak if we had a more systematized and well-funded system of victim assistance. And one of the things I call for in my book is a sort of global coalition that initiates this new brand of abolitionist movement. One division of this coalition will deal with the tactics required to eradicate slavery once and for all. The other division will be deployed to specifically deal with assisting the victims of slavery with an elevated level of resources and care.
And one form that that assistance takes that is very important is witness protection. For those who do get away and do choose to testify, you want to make sure that they are not victimized once again for standing up and trying to prevent this happening to anyone else.
That's exactly right. One of the reasons why there are so few convictions of these crimes are threats against the slaves, threats against their families that keep them from testifying. So we need a much more intelligent and well-funded system of witness protection, not just for them, but for their families, that includes some level of living income that will allow them to survive in safety long enough to participate in the jurisprudence process and hopefully have that result in a conviction of their exploiter.
An email from Wayne asks, is there a danger that a freed sex slave today will be a prostitute tomorrow because there is no place else to turn?
There's not only a danger of that, but in the course of my research, I learned about another severe danger that's increased in the last few years, which is re-trafficking and re-enslavement. Because slaves often return to the same conditions of poverty, abuse, lack of opportunity, social instability that resulted in their exploitation to begin with, I interviewed several slaves who had been re-enslaved, re-trafficked, and re-enslaved 2, 3, or 4 times. And this is something that simply must not stand.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Let's go next to Jennifer in Fort Worth. Hi, Jennifer.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I came up actually with a second question while I was on hold. I hope that's okay.
Just do it quick because we've got lots of people on the line.
Okay. My first question was how the impact of the illegal immigration debate what kind of impact is that having on trafficking and the discussion about trafficking? Also, what's happening for children who are kidnapped from other countries? How are they finding their way home? And I'll take my answers offline.
Thanks for your call.
Yeah, the immigration debate is at the center of this issue, not just here in the United States, but also in Europe. And the debate takes two sides. Number one, make borders stiffer, or number two, open them up. And the difficulty is, the reflex is, okay, if we erect a big wall, whether metaphorical or literal, we can stop the flow of not only illegal migrants, but also slaves, slave trading. But the problem is, the more difficult you make it to cross the border from a poor country into a rich country without addressing the poverty and instability and social the social instability in that poor country, you're still going to have desperate people who are trying to find a way to move from to a place where they have some chance of a life. And if you make it that much harder for them, you allow slave traders to fill that gap and say, I can help you get there. The problem is, if you make it easier, if you just open the borders, you also make it easier for slave traders to exploit the system. This is why, in my book, I say the global community must shift its focus from the movement portion of modern sex slavery to the exploitation portion of slavery. Focus on exploitation. Free the slaves. Round up the criminals. Movement is too difficult and too inexpensive for us to say, to pin our hat on ending sex slavery by focusing on the movement of people.
As Americans, we really love the idea of democracy and the thought that in a democratic society, a lot of other problems sort of sort themselves out. Is there, in fact, any evidence that democratic values within a country lead to fewer sex slaves? Or if poverty is still there and if corruption is still there, are those problems as big as ever?
You know, I'm a firm believer that in the long run, democracy and freedom is the best system we've got for organizing a society. Having said that, if that system is imposed too quickly on other countries, it actually makes matters worse. And what happened in Central and Eastern Europe after the fall of the Berlin Wall is sort of democratic and market economy principles were thrust on these countries so quickly that they had no ability to make the transition. It led to severe economic collapse, social instability, and cuts in social safety nets that left these people desperate, increased poverty levels significantly, and actually in Central Europe lowered life expectancies. That's how bad things got. So much so that when I interviewed people there, they said, look, democracy has made things a lot worse for us. And in their more recent elections, they've reelected communist governments. This happened in Moldova most recently. Which probably suffered the worst of any country in the former Soviet Union. So the transition to democracy was not handled well. And that's something I think that the United States in particular has to take responsibility for because it is a key driver of the accretion in the last 15 to 20 years in sex slavery.
Let's speak next to CJ in Plano. Hi, CJ.
Hello.
Hi.
Yes. I was just going to make a quick comment. I really do appreciate your guests and some of their solutions they have suggested. But it's my feeling that I would like to see women have more of a say. I'd like to see women have more of an influence in this world that we live in. Unfortunately, men rule this world that we live in today. And there are parts of this world that we live in today that women are still slaves in some other way, you know. And it is my belief that within the woman is where most or all of these problems are going to be solved. And I want to see women have more of a say in this world that we live in. Thank you.
Thanks very much for your call. Did you find, Siddharth, that women are ever taking a role in enslaving other women?
Well, unfortunately, the answer is yes. I take the caller's point very seriously, and that is the global severe asymmetry and female access to education, employment, and justice is a key driver of their vulnerability to slavery. Now, having said that, we talked earlier in this hour about the way in which slaves may adapt to their conditions. And for some of them, that is to associate with the worldview. It's called sort of a Stockholm Syndrome-type transformation. They associate with their captors and become one of them. And then in the future, act out the same violence they suffered on future slaves, or go into their home villages and regions to recruit new slaves. And I really look at this as a way in which these individuals have had undergone such brutal treatment that they've been forced to adapt to that worldview in order to just make life make sense.
John Miller, who for a time headed the Justice Department's efforts against human trafficking in this country, has since come out and criticized the Bush administration for failing to follow through on its own initiatives. Do you agree with that?
I do. The Bush administration got off to a good foot on this issue, believe it or not, and really took it seriously, passed some very important legislation, set up a State Department office to deal with it, and that was all great. But the problem was the level of resources that were deployed to deal with the issue were simply insufficient, and the global approach to this issue was simply insufficient. I'll give you an analogy. Right now, we spend 300 times more money to fight the war on drugs than we do to fight any sort of war on slavery. And that asymmetry in resource deployment is simply unconscionable, given the stain, the moral stain that we can all agree slavery is on humanity.
Do you have a sense that the Obama administration will make this issue a priority?
I hope so. I mean, at so many levels, it would be so appropriate for the Obama administration to really pick up this ball and run with it, and to elevate our efforts, not just here but around the world, in adopting a broader, more well-funded, more intelligently deployed abolitionist movement. And at so many levels, for obvious reasons, the Obama administration would do well, I think, to take this issue on and make it a policy priority.
In the minute or so we have left, can you talk about some of the things that you think individuals can do who want to be part of the solution?
Yeah, in my book, I describe four key steps that individuals can take. Number one is awareness. Listening to a show like this, reading a book like mine, just learning what is going on. I also talk about crying out. Write to your senators. Tell them to read this book. Tell them to elevate the resources and attention that are being deployed to this issue. Individuals can also be involved in the Community Vigilance Committee that I discuss in the book. I hope to set up that system here in the United States, and individuals can play a key role in being the front lines of a global abolitionist movement. So there are several things that individuals can do. The fourth thing being finding and supporting these NGOs that we've talked about, who are very resource constrained and who are doing great work to try to increase the livelihood, the quality of life of these individuals once they're freed.
Siddharth Kara serves on the board of directors for the human rights organization Free the Slaves. His new book is called Sex Trafficking: Inside the Business of Modern Slavery. Siddharth, thank you so much for spending the hour with us.
It's been my pleasure.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thank you for listening and have a great day.
Think is produced by Jeff Whittington and engineered by Jeannie Mascoro. Learn about upcoming programs, subscribe to our free daily podcast, and order CD copies of your favorite Think shows on the radio page of KERA.org. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@KERA.org.